So I would like to continue this evening on the topic that I've been doing the last 2 weeks, which is the Buddhist idea of self and not self, and kind of explore it from different angles, and hopefully angles that make some sense out of it, since many people can't make any sense out of the Buddhist teachings on not self when it's sometimes taught in a more philosophical way. So there is a story from the time of the Buddha's life where the Buddha was sitting in a pleasure park, in a park someplace in the grove of trees, meditating. And nearby, there came a group of aristocrats to enjoy the pleasure park, to have a picnic. And apparently these young princesses and their wives came and had this party and picnic, and one of the princes came with a courtesan because I guess he didn't have a wife or something. And after their picnic and their partying, whatever they did, they all took a nap. And while they were napping, the courtesan plucked all the jewelry off the aristocrats and went running away with all the jewelry. And so when these young men and women woke up from their naps and realized that they'd been robbed, they went wandering through the pleasure park looking for this woman, thinking she might still be there. And they came across the Buddha meditating. Can you hear okay? Is there trouble hearing? Is it okay working? So they came across the Buddha meditating, and they asked the Buddha, "Have you seen a woman walking by, wandering by?" And the Buddha said, "What would you rather find, a woman or yourself?" And that got their attention, and so they all sat down, and the Buddha gave teachings to these young men and women, and many of them became the Buddha's disciples, students. It's a happy story, right? So what would you rather find? The perfect relationship or yourself? What would you rather find? The greatest job or yourself? A lot of money, the lottery, or yourself? What would you rather find? What's an important thing to do in life? So here the Buddha is pointing to what's more important. And there's something very important about finding oneself. And so what does that take to find oneself? And I think there's many answers to that question. Each of you maybe has your own answer. I would like to propose that one of the things it could mean is slowing down long enough to be able to find out what you feel, what you think, what motivates you, what you believe, to find out what's really here in this psychophysical being here. Because I know it's very easy to be busy with life, busy with preoccupations, and that to really miss what is here, not even really pay attention, not even know what we believe or what's happening. So to slow down enough or sit still enough to listen very deeply. There's a story that's often told in our circles that I've told of from the Ramayana, of Rama, God Rama, going through the jungle with some companions. And he hears this very faint voice calling out his name, Rama, Rama. And he asks his companions if they hear that voice. And no one hears it except for him. And so he goes through the jungle listening, you know, towards the sound, walking towards the sound. And finally he comes to this big boulder. And he hears that sound, his name, Rama, is coming out of this boulder. And so he takes his hands and gently places it on the boulder. And at that point, the boulder breaks open or dissolves or something. And this beautiful goddess or deva or something comes forth from that boulder. And she had been somehow enchanted or cast in a spell and kept frozen captive in this boulder for maybe a long time. And what's very interesting about this story is her name. Her name is Alaya. And Alaya means home. So Himalaya means snow home, home of the snow. So Alaya, home. So that's her name, home. So only he could hear this very faint whisper that was calling him home. Isn't that nice? So what's your faint whisper that's calling you home? And then he had to put his hands, so kind of really be there. Really be there, so you didn't, touch it. Something touch something very deeply. A few days ago, I heard Jon Kabat-Zinn talk about the dictionary entry in the Oxford Dictionary for the word touch. And I didn't look it up to find out to confirm it, but he says that it's the longest entry in the Oxford Dictionary. It's longer than the entry for love. And so touch, you know, it's very basic. So to touch, what does it mean to be in touch with yourself? However, when we go to find out who we are, which is, I think, the task of many spiritual traditions, some of the obvious answers to who we are start dissolving, start breaking open as we investigate and look at them. Some of the things that we might think, oh, this is who I really am, doesn't stand up under scrutiny. And so it's a very interesting process of really looking deeply and finding out, wait a minute, not this. This is not who I really am. And then we look more deeply and no, that's not either. And we keep going towards something. Maybe we hear this, our name being called. And often it's a process of shedding a lot of, some people call, sometimes we'll call it false beliefs of who we are, arbitrary beliefs of who we are, limiting ways in which we think we are. And for some people, it becomes a bit of a mystery. Who am I? Who am I? Here I'm supposed to find out who I am, but the more I look, the more mysterious it becomes. So that process of kind of the mystery of it all is very interesting. And I was first introduced to it not through Buddhism, but through the study of science. When I was a college student, I took various science classes like biology and botany. And I was actually blown away by my experience of studying science. And I could say, having done an undergraduate degree in science and a graduate degree in religious studies at Stanford, of all places, I can say that my science classes were more religious than my religious studies classes. My sense of awe and, you know, sense of the mystery and, you know, something, just really something. And I remember once in botany class, introduction to botany, and we were studying the carbon dioxide oxygen kind of cycles. And there was this big beautiful diagram on the chalkboard of how, you know, the plants produce oxygen and human beings and animals and other places produce carbon dioxide, and we kind of, this big cycle goes round and around. And it was a pretty basic idea. But as I left the classroom out onto campus, there were all these beautiful trees around me. And I stood there in awe of these trees. And kind of almost like a religious sense of awe, where the sense of who I was, the boundaries of it, dissolved. Because I sat there kind of contemplating that I needed the trees to produce oxygen more than I needed my eyes, more than I needed, you know, certainly one kidney. There's a lot of things that are very intimate and important part of who I think I am, but I could more easily do without them than I could do without in these plants that are producing oxygen. And so I was wondering, where do I begin and where do I end? And that was a sense of mystery that I had. Where do I begin, where do I end? If that, you know, if I'm so dependent on this external world. And then I remember also in, I don't know if it was botany or biology class, studying mitochondria. And it's been 30 years since I studied this stuff. So, I think that the biological knowledge is, in the last 30 years, is probably multiplied in times in all of time before 1976. But in any case, my knowledge might be kind of dated. But back then, the theory that was most active about the mitochondria was that mitochondria originally were single-celled animals or beings that were distinct and independent, that somehow were absorbed into a bigger cell. And that as cellular life evolved and developed and eventually become complex animals, those mitochondria multiplied together with the cells and just came along for the ride. And mitochondria are very important because they're the energy powerhouse for cells, which is kind of like the battery. And here the theory was that this essential battery for every single cell of a living being is a foreign object, is a foreign being. You know, you look around and you have a lot of cells in your body, and you know, and every cell that you have, there's another being in there. You know, you've been possessed. You know, it's something, you know, that somehow has been absorbed and just kind of travels along with you. That's how it's set up. I thought that was pretty amazing. Where do I begin? Where do I end? Who am I? Am I made up of two creatures? Human beings and mitochondria? I thought that was kind of amazing. I don't know what it does for you, but I was kind of amazed by that. Where do I begin? Where do I end? Who am I? And then if you look at, you know, again, a little bit this physiology of a human being, and you realize that if you look inside of yourself, you're mostly made up of space. And I don't know what you know, if you compress yourself, you take all the space away, you know, you probably, I don't know, what size would you become? You know, I don't know, you'd probably smaller than the period at the end of a sentence? Probably less than that, right? If all the space goes away, we're mostly made up of space. It's just astounding how much space we're made up of. So, you know, here I am, right? So what's that about, space? And then, we're made up of water. Someone know what percentage we're made up of water? What? 72. She's 72 and he's 80%. Depends on 90 something. Lot. You know, and so we're made up of water. You know, a big chunk of who we are is water. And this water has been, I guess some of it gets created here and there as we go along, but some of it, I imagine, has been kind of cycling through this world for hundreds and thousands of, maybe millions of years. And, you know, and the water we drink today probably has gone through and been passed through the bodies in some way or other of countless beings before us. And so even the water we make up, you know, is just recycled material. And then besides our water, then we're made up of other stuff, you know, carbon. We're carbon-based creatures. And the carbon we're made up of is, you know, really recycled. You know, human beings are into recycled material. That's what we do. We go out and look for material that's recycled and recycle it again. That's all it is. You know, we're the original, you know, not original, but we've made up all this recycled material stuff. Now, all this stuff, the material of our life, the material goods of our life that come together because we eat and kind of happen into our life, is that who we are? Are we this material body? Are we this that passes through? And can we take it to be this is who I really am? Do I find who I really am in the water? 70, 80, 90% were water. We find it in the carbon. We find it in the magnesium. We find it in the potassium. Where do we find it? Do we find it in the carbon and in the organic compounds that make us up? You know, where is this? Who are we that? A lot of that's interchangeable. A lot of it we can do without. And some of it we can't. So we don't find it necessarily there so easily. You don't find it in your, you know, and you know. So obviously, if you cut your hair off, are you more or less who you really are? And then there's a, and then if you look more deeply, besides the material being of who we are, I'm astounded by some of the research being done about the brain and the nervous system and the chemicals that make it all go. Just this week, I read a story about how the kind of intelligences of men and women, as a generalization, tend to be different depending on the presence and absence of certain hormones, especially in gestation. The embryo gets kind of, you know, if men get all this testosterone at an early age, when they're still an embryo, it kind of creates a certain kind of intelligence. Apparently spatial intelligence gets really strong under the influence of testosterone. And as a human being, as an adult, apparently you can play with hormone levels and can change intelligence, how the mind works and the brain works. And as my wife found out, she went through, for 3 months, medically induced temporary menopause many years ago. And after a few months of that, she said, "These thoughts are not my thoughts." Now, that was pretty wise of her to see it that way. She didn't identify them with them. She said, these thoughts are not my thoughts. And so, you know, hormones, you know, fluctuate and change. The chemical levels fluctuate and change. And they have a huge impact on what we think and what we believe. Certain kinds of psychological, unusual, original states of mind happen because not only do we have delusive thinking of what's going on, but there seems to be chemicals involved in convincing us that they're true. You know, it's not just simply that we think they're true. There's actually these kind of chemicals that get, you know, that kind of want us to believe certain things. One of the things that kind of, I guess, I don't know who, psychologists, neurobiologists have pointed out, that one of the, seemingly for many people, one of the common delusions of human beings is that we think better of ourselves than we really are. Now, I don't know how they got to that conclusion, because most people I know think they're worse than they really are. But maybe it's a combination of that. But somehow there's this, we kind of delude ourselves. We lie to ourselves about all kinds of things about ourselves. And what's that based upon? And we start kind of digging into the physiology and the neurology of the brain. We find that there's all this kind of, you know, all these influences of biology on how we think, and maybe even what we believe, how our mind works, the intelligences that we have, the processes, mental processes we do. So do we find ourselves in that? If you take a new hormone and you start having new kinds of thoughts, is your thinking you? Just, you know, well, yes, if you take chemicals, then if you take some kind of hormones, of course, then the new thoughts are not you. The new thoughts are someone else's or something else, right? But the old thoughts, that's really who you are, right? Because the old hormones, they're accurate. The ones you kind of somehow came in, you know, just have so-called naturally, that's who you are. So you don't have to go very far in the literature of neurobiology, of psychology, of sociology, of many different places to begin realizing that in the modern scientific world, the self as some kind of essential self begins disappearing. And I think that modern science has much better arguments or evidence for saying there is no self than Buddhism has. they found certain brain centers in the mind, in the brain, that seems to be the brain centers that even manufacture the sense of self. This is me, this is myself, this is mine. And if those aren't operating, then the sense "this is mine" doesn't exist. One of the things that I've read in this kind of study of neurobiology is some scientists will say that human beings exist in a very strong interdependent world. We're dependent on our mothers. We're dependent on our parents, our families, our community, our society. There's a very strong level of dependence. And one of the functions of some of these hormones and brain centers and whatever is to create a sense of individual. It's very distinct and separate. And so there's this kind of play between being dependent and being independent that seems to be built into some of the structures of the brain. Does that mean that the structures of the brain are real. You know, the fact that the mind can create these things, it's constructed and created. Is it arbitrary? What is it? So I find that this in the study of science, it becomes kind of weirder and weirder who we are. Or it becomes more and more mystery. Who are we? And what makes us tick? What makes us believe what we believe? What makes us have the feelings we have, the desires we have, the impulses we have? What's going on here? Who's in charge? Are your hormones in charge? And then probably a good percentage of you have probably had times when your hormones were clearly in charge. And later you realize, wow, what was that about? I did things that I didn't even want to do. So are those hormones really you, or who are you and all that? I had the good fortune to have known, I guess now I know, 5 generations of Franz Dahls. My father, I knew my grandfather, I knew my great-grandfather, and I know my sons also. But I know in the generations of myself, going back to my great-grandfather, I see there are certain personality traits that seem to be consistent. And I don't know if they're going traveling into my sons yet. But if those personality traits existed before me in this lineage, are they really who I am? Are they really who I am? Or are they, you know, what are they? Who am I? What are those things? Can I claim to be who I am? I don't know. I find all these things kind of mysterious. Who am I? I think reflection on oneself, like analysis, analyzing oneself, sometimes is really interesting. A few weeks ago, I participated in a meeting where I had a little bit of strong words with someone. And there was a lot of inner processing going on in my decision to have these strong words with someone else. And because it was a little bit unusual in that context, I had these strong words, I spent a lot of time afterwards reflecting, what was going on there for me? And it was very interesting for me to reflect, because the more I reflected what was going on, the more I started unpacking more and more what was going on in that situation. More of my understanding, my views, my beliefs, my motivations, my intentions, my feelings, the background of what was going on over the last days, the sense of the group, sense of history of the group, my relationship to the history of the group. It just got so amazingly full, rich, what was all going on in my choice to have these strong words with someone. And at the time, I had no idea it was so complex. But I took the time to think about it over some days, and wow, there's a lot going on here. So where am I in that? Who am I? Who am I? And as I think many of you know, in some spiritual traditions, a central question for spiritual life, or practice question, is the question, who am I? Who am I? And just ask that over and over again. For some people, it's very profound to ask that. And the way that it's most profound for me is not in getting an answer. Oh, now I figured it out. I spent long enough for that answer, that question, now I figured it out. What I found is most satisfying to me with the answers that come to me are the answers where I realize I'm not this, I'm not this, no, I'm not that, I'm not that, I'm not that, I'm not that, I'm not that. So what are you? What are you not? That's an interesting question. So who are you? Or you can ask, who are you not? And who are you really not? So I sit here in front of you, and you could ask me, who are you, Gil? And I could say, oh, I'm a Dharma teacher. Is that who I really am? It's a role that I'm playing now for all of you. And I go home, and let me tell you, if I take this role at home, my wife will say, Gil, you're using that tone of voice again. And so the Dharma teaching Gil, is that who I really am? So I don't see that as who I really am. Am I a father? Am I a husband? Am I a son? Is that who I really am? They're kind of, or are they more like clothes that I wear? That sometimes are useful concepts and sometimes get in the way and they're not useful. Who am I really? Am I really a kind person? Is that who I really am? I don't know if I was kind when I had those strong words, that person. I know I've been burdened sometimes by thinking I need to be a kind person. What a burden that is. So who am I? I'd rather not see myself as a kind person. Even less, I want to see myself as an unkind person. But I don't know. I don't need to see myself that way. Choose those concepts. Am I my age? I'm 51 years old. Is that who I am? I think the older I get, the less age has any meaning to me. Seems kind of an empty concept in some ways. Am I my gender? Does gender define who I really am? I know for some other people it is. But I don't identify that strongly with gender. It seems to disappear plenty of times, plenty of situations. Doesn't seem like something that's going to represent some essential aspect of who I am. Am I my ethnicity? My ethical background? Doesn't hold me very tightly. I'm Norwegian. I was born in Norway. I don't quite identify as an American. I don't quite identify as Norwegian. I don't really care so much. I wish they had United Nations passports for everybody who wanted one. I would take that quickly. Am I my accomplishments in the past? I could wear my accomplishments like a badge. My latest one, you know, is that book I translated, got published last year, Dhammapada. I could, like, you know, we can put a poster up here behind me. So that you really know that I'm somehow intimately and tightly connected to that piece of that accomplishment. So that every time you see me, you get down to your floor and you bow, and you just think, you know, I'm really great. And, you know, it's really, you know, I don't think I don't identify very much with my accomplishments. A little bit. It brings me some joy, but am I who I really am, my accomplishments, things I've done in the past? Am I my past experiences? When I traveled to France many years ago, some of the French people I encountered said, the Americans are really strange. They seem to only want to talk about what they've done. I don't know if it's true or not, but that was anecdotal evidence that few people I talked to, that the Americans like to talk about what they've done, their story. And I don't know what they talk about in France otherwise. What else is there? But, you know, am I my story? Am I my past? All my past experiences? How quick, you know, quickly some of us are, I can be it sometimes, to want to tell people about let me tell you about who I was in the past, what I did in the past. Is that who I am? Am I really what I'm going to be in the future? I think that a lot of things that people take as who they are, you know, if you really investigate carefully and really question, is this who I really am? It begins to fall away. And Buddhist spirituality and other spiritualities as well is very much involves this kind of shedding of identities of who we think we really are, which really get in the way, are limiting us, self-limiting. And I think it's pretty easy to see other people who limit themselves by their identity. Someone who thinks, you know, oh, I'm not good enough. I'm not worthy. I couldn't do that. And you know, you see how ridiculous it is. I mean, how could they limit themselves so much that way? You know, you're good enough. You could do it. Don't burden yourself with that kind of limitation. It's a view of who they are. Or sometimes people put you in a category. I know sometimes spouses can be seen sometimes through the perspective of their spouse. You know, that you don't seem to exist at all, but it's because of who, you know, your spouse, that they see, oh, you're so-and-so's husband or so-and-so's wife. And it feels kind of yucky to be seen only that way. You know, hey, I'm here, you know. I'm not just a wife or a husband, you know. I'm who I am. Don't limit me. Don't keep me bound by that. Or once upon a time, you had angry words with someone. You know, it doesn't happen that often, but once. And from then on, the person thinks of you as an angry person. Please, don't, you know, limit me that way. Don't hold me in that box. I'm more than that. What's hardest to see, so it's easy to see when other people do it. It's easy to see when people do it towards us. What's most difficult to see is when we do it towards ourselves. We limit ourselves. But one of the clues that we do this is that we suffer. If we feel unhappy or feel dissatisfaction or feel pressure or feel oppressed or feel held back or weighed down, all those are kind of symptoms, can be symptoms of the limitation of self-concept and self-ideas. And the shedding of identity, shedding all these things that this is who I really am kind of idea, shedding, some people will see it as being a diminishing of the self, that I'm less and less, I'm not really here. Other people will see it as being an expansion of the self because there's nothing that stands in the way. There's no boundaries to who we are. It's like being in a whole series of concentric boxes and somehow you begin shedding the boxes from the inside out and you get more and more and more space as you kind of shed those limiting constructs that hold us in. And eventually the last box gets opened and you realize there's infinite space all around you, and it's great. So I believe that there are times, some people have intimations of a shift of identity or shedding of identity. For some people, it can be spending a lot of time in nature. It can do it. Some people, back in the old days, it used to be taking drugs. I don't know about nowadays. People don't tell me anymore what they do. But back when I was young, there were people who took a lot of drugs. And it was a big shift of identity that happened with that. And sometimes childbirth can be a huge shift of identity. It's very powerful, shedding of a lot of stuff. I've known a lot of parents now, since now I'm a parent. And it's really amazing how parenting causes one to shed a lot of identity. Because old identity, just you don't have time for it. So there are certain things in life that can kind of cause that shift, sometimes temporary shifts. Or we get an intimation or intuition of something is different than the usual constricted ways in which we hold ourselves and see ourselves. And then the question is, how do I live into some more Well, I have to be careful what I say. So I could say into more expanded sense of self, or unlimited sense of self, or freed sense of self. The technically correct Buddhist thing to say is to say something like, how do I live into freedom from the limitations of self? Freedom from the limitations of self-concept. And the reason why that's technically correct is the first way is say, how do I live into an expanded sense of self, leaves you with an idea of who you are. I'm an expanded sense of self. That's who I am. But the Buddhist way of looking at this is mostly negative. It's wording it negatively. Focusing on what's absent. Freeing ourselves. So just talking about the freedom from the limiting concepts and attachments to self. And what we are and what happens once we're free from these limitations, the Buddha preferred not to say. Is that very... Is that satisfying? So here he said to these aristocrats, what would you rather find, the woman or yourself? And then the Buddha offers a path, a practice, that involves a shedding of a lot of identity, seeing through, penetrating through the constructs. And then in the end, you don't find anything to hold on to. So it's kind of like, you know, false advertisement at the beginning. So how to be free from all this stuff. So people have some intimation sometimes of the possibility of a shift of identity or change of identity or shedding of identity. And one of the ways then to live into that is through meditation practice. And meditation practice, the calming of the meditation, calming of that activity of the mind that's making up self, the insight of meditation where you actually can see through and understand what's going on, understand, see how it's constructed, how it's created, to penetrate through it, and through the veils of it, is a very, very powerful process. And what you're trying to do in deep Buddhist meditation practice is to kind of shed the veils of selfing enough that you get down and start seeing the very beginnings of it, what prompts it in the first place? What is the inner motivation? What is the inner prompt for trying to create a sense of self, hold on to a sense of self with attachment? What's the prompt that wants to cling to self, self-concept and ideas? And then the idea is to see that initial early prompt and then find some way to relax that. And when you relax that, what happens? So last week, if you remember last week, those of you who came, I talked about the three kinds of clingings that have to do with meing, mining, and myselfing. Remember that? Me, myself, and mine. That activity. And the Buddha said something very interesting to a monk once. He said, there is this activity where the mind constructs a sense of possessiveness, possession. There is this activity where the mind creates concepts about who I am. There is this activity where the mind creates some views about who I essentially am in my essence. And these activities of the mind go on. They're all activities of the mind. But if you look through the activity to the ground from which that activity arises, from the object, from the brain or the mind or the inner place, the mind that creates that activity. And if you can see that the ground out of which it arises is not self, is not mine, and not the self, then you're freed from the activity. That makes sense? So if you understand that to say it maybe very crudely, to say that the deep inner process or the inner machine, the inner that bubbles from out of which bubbles up the idea, oh, this is who I really am. If that inner process that bubbles up, this is who I really am, is that inner process is seen as being not self, then whatever thoughts that process creates are seen through and penetrated. So, to drop below the level of our thoughts, and what is there in our brain, in our mind, in our hearts? And last thing I'll say is that in Buddhism, all this discussion like this is not kind of idle philosophy or, you know, cute philosophy or something, but it's really a part of the pointing to the possibility of setting the heart at peace, to discover the deepest levels of peace, well-being, and happiness that's possible for a human being. That can happen when we've shed all of the unnecessary false attachments to self that kind of agitate the heart and disturb the deep inner peace that's there. How many times can I say this is the last thing I'm going to say? What I've tried to do this evening, carefully, you might not have heard what I didn't say. But what I didn't say, made no claim that the Buddha taught that there is no self. I didn't say that. What I said is that this is not self. This is not self. This is not self. This is not self. All these things, you can find all these things and say, question, is this self? No, that's not self. This is not self. This is not self. But I didn't say that there is no self. Isn't that interesting? So now I will stop. And let that hang for the week. And if you're interested in this topic some more, then I'll continue with this next week. Thank you.